You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on SiriusXM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across the Americas, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world. Simulcast is TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide via Free Speech TV. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Pleased to have you with us today. A lot going. We've tracked down Scott Olson's roommate. He's going to be on the show in the second hour, the third hour, actually, of our program. Scott Olson is the guy who got shot in the head with a tear gas canister and is in critical condition in the hospital in Oakland. And I want to get into that in some depth. In our second hour, Peter Farrar is going to drop by. He's hysterical about Obama's regulating industry. Oh, my God, it's going to destroy America. Cliff Schechter will be with us in a few minutes about what's going on in Ohio. And of course, there's a lot of other news in the media. The whole thing, though, I read a piece the other day that I thought was yesterday that I thought was absolutely so spot on. And Danny Goldberg wrote this. Danny is the author of numerous books, including It's a Free Country, Dispatches in the Culture Wars, How the Left Lost Teen Spirit, and Bumping into Geniuses. And he's also the president of Gold Village Entertainment and was the CEO of Air America Radio from 2005 until the mid-2006s. And I should disclose, Danny hired me there. And Danny, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's so nice to talk to you again, Tom.
Indeed. It's been a long time, and it's great to hear your voice. DannyGoldberg.com, by the way, the website. But to the point of your article, I thought this was brilliant because I was there, and I suspect you probably were, too. I don't think we've ever had this conversation, but the headline of the article is Don't Diss the Drum Circles, Why Hippie Culture is Still Important to Our Protests. And in the late 1960s, 67, 68, 69, in East Lansing, Michigan, I had hair down on my shoulders and smoked pot and was hanging out with the SDS group and showing up for the demonstrations and getting tear gassed in the streets. And I can tell you there was incredible tension because probably three quarters of the SDS folks wanted to dress like young conservatives or something close to it, or more like the old socialists, you know, roll up the sleeves but keep your hair short. And they thought that those of us who had long hair were polluting the movement. And on the other hand, there were the hippies who were looking at the SDS people going, they're just too uptight. And then there were a few of us who were kind of straddling both worlds, and in times it was uncomfortable. Your riff on this actually goes a whole lot deeper than that, so let me just toss it to you.
Well, you know, the impetus to me for writing it was Occupy Wall Street and the way a lot of the left pundits, columnists, and people on the TV shows have been talking about it. Because I think, like a lot of your listeners and like you, it's so exciting to me to see the Occupy Wall Street movement growing, because it's just changed the conversation in a way that we desperately have needed for years. And you know, the truth is that people like you and a lot of our friends have been talking about wealth disparity for, you know, certainly all the labor unions have been, and some of the great progressive economists, you know, for years and years and years. But there's been like a glass wall that stopped it from reaching the minds of the majority of Americans. Most Americans aren't listening to your show or reading The Nation or Dissent magazine, where I wrote my piece, and that's the website that it's on if anyone wants to read it. And somehow this movement, which is very fragile, has been able to penetrate into the mass consciousness. And a lot of the people on the left kept making fun of what the drum circles. That was sort of, right. It was as if to be intellectually respected, you know, in the political world. And I'm talking about the left now, not the mainstream media. You know, you had to make fun of the drum circles and the free hugs and disparage the notion of hippies. And you know, I just observed that, you know, these hippies, if that's what you want to call them, the sort of the spiritual component of this movement is what came up with a phrase like, we are the 99%. You know, our our intellectual brothers and sisters have not come up with a slogan that captured the imagination of people like that. And I think it's really important to respect that spiritual, if you want to call it hippie component of it, because it touches people's hearts and souls in a way that op-ed pieces and position papers don't always do. And it reminded me of the same mistake that was made in the late 60s by a lot of the radicals to condescend to or look down on people as they considered to be hippies. And the truth is, as I said, you know, the Grateful Dead ended up reaching a lot more people than the hippies ever did.
Yeah. And SDS for that matter, and so did George Harrison, as you point out. Although he had his own internal contradictions, but the Beatles.
He did, but he was basically a force for good. You know.
Yeah.
You're not going to get party lines or precise agreement on position papers from the worlds of either art or spirituality. But if you get a general set of values, which is that we're all equal in God's eyes, and that public policy has to reflect that, and a public policy that creates more and more disparity of wealth and a smaller and smaller fraction of people who are benefiting from policies in the systems is therefore immoral, you know, that's an extremely useful set of values to be out there for progressive activists.
You know, Danny, Albert Einstein famously said, or perhaps apocryphally said, I don't know, but religion without science is blind. Science without religion is, what was the word he used? Soulless? I forget.
Man, you're the one with these quotes.
Right.
I don't know.
Well, in any case,
you know, whatever it is, it's you need both.
Yeah, and it wasn't actually. He didn't say. Yeah.
And as a practical matter, you need both, because if you don't get public opinion aroused, of course the Democratic politicians are going to go where the money is.
Right.
They're politicians. If you get public opinion aroused, you have a chance of changing.
Well, and you point out in this article so brilliantly how on the right, the Republicans embrace the religious component within their base.
They do, whether it's people like the evangelicals or whether it's sort of these radical people like Ayn Rand followers, which is really another set of values. I think it's a fundamentally evil set of values, what I call the cult of selfishness and, you know, social Darwinism. But, you know, Paul Ryan openly says he's a devotee of Ayn Rand. Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Fed, was a personal disciple of hers. And you'll never hear them bad-mouthing these people. You know, Glenn Beck tries to infuse what he's doing with the spiritual, because people want to feel that what they're doing is good. They're not only motivated by self-interest. Self-interest is part of it, but it's just simply not true to say that that's the only thing that motivates people's political opinions. And the successful movements arouse a sense of idealism and altruism while also understanding people's self-interest. And the right wing has, I think in an evil but very successful way understood that, and you'll never see them condescending to the spiritual components of their movement, even when they have really crazy people involved. Like,
well, I don't think that the left wing.
Thing.
I don't think the left wing has yet acknowledged, at least the professional political analysts, as you point out, has even understands that the hippies or whatever they're called today, the drum circles, are a spiritual component. We have 1 minute.
You just have to try to observe the reality that they've reached people's hearts and souls in a way that the op-ed pieces couldn't. And we need both. We need legislators. We need policy analysts. But, you know, what the policy people should be doing every day now is coming up with things that are for the 99%.
Yeah.
It's not the job of those people in the park to do that. It's our job to say, get rid of the bankruptcy bill.
Yeah. And fairness is a spiritual value, if I may interject.
Yeah.
And you had this great quote from Martin Luther King. You want to share it?
Well, there was a famous rivalry in the civil rights movement between the old line groups like the NAACP and Dr. King. And Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, mocked King once after the march in Washington and said, "How many laws did you pass, Martin? How many laws did you change?" And King said, "None, Roy, but I think we changed a lot of hearts."
There you go.
And
that's
the
word.
Is, it takes both.
Danny Goldberg, you can read his piece. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can read his piece over at Dissent Magazine on their website. And it's titled, "Don't Diss the Drum Circles." Danny, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. So the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. So not a chance. Tom Hartman here with you. Cliff Schechter is with us. He is the National Progressive PR Strategist with Libertas LLC, nationally syndicated columnist for Al Jazeera English and author of the book The Real McCain, LibertasLLC.com. Of course, the website. Cliff, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm watching Mitt Romney dangle in the wind, and it's really quite remarkable. And now he's, you know, I remember back, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whenever the last, you know, before this one, presidential cycle was around, and Romney was running, and these people were, there was a flipper. There was a guy dressed up who was walking around the CPAC conference that I was broadcasting from. And they were passing out flippers, Mitt flippers.
Right.
And here he is on Senate Bill 5. Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, you know, it shouldn't be shocking. You know, I think it's not smart politics for him. He should take a look at what's going on in Ohio here. But, I mean, of course, he's supporting Senate Bill 5. And you have a ton of corporate money flooding in here right now. To defend Senate Bill 5 polls. I mean, I don't want people to become overconfident, but polls are showing, the PPP poll showed repealing this anti-collective bargaining bill. You know, it has a 20-point lead, repeal versus keeping it. You've seen, I mean, Bill Cunningham, you may know who he is, Tom, is the kind of the right-wing Rush Limbaugh of Cincinnati, came out against Senate Bill 5 and said it should be repealed because firefighters and police actually do good work. I know that's shocking. To know that, I mean, it's lost. You know, it lost a guy that Alec is behind this. We've talked about before. The American Legislative Exchange Council is pouring in all sorts of money just to defend Kasich. And one of their guys, they gave an award at one point for being one of their stars, Bill Seitz, who's a state senator here. He voted against it. I mean, you have to really understand how extreme this bill is, and the fact that people you'd expect to be supporting it aren't. So Romney, that's where he chooses to line up. And hopefully if people come out and vote and the revolution is real, which I think people really are out there now getting excited about this thing's going to go down, but not to get overconfident, of course.
Yeah. So do you think that as a political observer and consultant, do you think that whether this goes down or not, whether this is won or not, you know, there's that old saying, you know, a week is an eternity in politics, and there's a lot of variations on it, but...
Sure.
But basically, we're talking about an election that's going to be almost a year before the presidential elections. This election on whether or not to take down Senate Bill 5. That's like next month, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. The election is coming up on November 8th. I mean,
it's a couple
right
weeks
there.
Away. Right.
It's a shame. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you know, regardless of Romney's position, isn't this something that will just, you know, be a distant part of the noise in the distant past when election day comes in 2012?
Yeah, no, I think it will be for Romney. I mean, I just think it's one of, it just, again, the guy's got no core, and every time he does something else, changes a previous position. I think he was much more pro-union when he was governor of Massachusetts. It once again just shows that he has no soul, and I think that's something in the longer term that's going to be a problem for him. You know, in terms of the bill here, I think it's important in and of itself because this is a chance, just kind of like the recalling of the two state senators was in Wisconsin,
right,
a chance for people to show they aren't going to take this. The middle class is not willing to be squeezed out of existence.
Let's quickly explain what Senate Bill 5 is.
So, I mean, basically, it's a similar bill to the one in Wisconsin. It removes collective bargaining rights, from public employees.
From state employees.
I'm sorry?
From state employees.
Yes, from state employees, but it went further than Wisconsin because Wisconsin didn't include members of the police force as well as firefighters, which they decide here that, you know, John Kasich famously called a policeman who pulled him over when he was speeding an idiot. So he kind of was great at showing the disrespect these guys have for firefighters and police officers, and they've become a big part of this coalition to defeat this thing. It needed about 200,000 or a little less signatures. It got 1.3 million to get it on the ballot. We've talked about that before. And, you know, I can tell you from being on the ground, I'm in Columbus, Ohio. I mean, I haven't seen people this fired up since the 2008 election. So that doesn't guarantee anything. And, again, I don't want anybody getting overconfident. People need to turn out and they need to vote. But right now, you know, it's looking like this could be a huge defeat for Kasich. And again, what these groups like ALEC get is what happens on the state level, particularly in big, important states, is often a model. You know, the anti-tax revolt in California ended up going national.
Right.
You know, what begins in the state often gets out there. Now, we can reject what Kasich did by a big margin here in Ohio and say, no, you're not going to continue to attack unions. Not only does it weaken Kasich here, but I think it also sends a national message that the corporations can't just run roughshod over us with the people just lying down and taking it, much like the Occupy Wall Street movement has shown and others. And so I think this is part of that, maybe the opposite side of that same coin, you know, what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. In the minute we have left, you talk about, in Reasonable, the main television ad paid for by the RGA's Make Ohio Great Governor Kasich appears in casual dress and talks about reasonable reform. What's going on with this?
Well, they realized, first of all, they overstepped in terms of Kasich. He actually tried to come back to the bargaining table with unions, and they said get lost once he had already gone after them.
Right.
In terms of the RGA, oh, yeah, you make Ohio great. The Alliance for, the American Future, which I think is Mary Chaney.
What is the RGA?
Oh, Republican Governors Association.
Okay.
And they spent a ton of money on Kasich. He was their guy. Rupert Murdoch gave them $1 million. The Koch brothers gave them $1 million each to spend on Kasich. And so, you know, he's been one of their big guys from the beginning. But right now, you know, you've got all these different groups. As I said, the group run by Mary Chaney. You've got Americans for Prosperity. Everybody knows Koch-funded group that's going around doing town halls all over the state. A lot of advertising money coming in. A lot of it's being, being laundered through the RGA, so people don't know where it's coming from. It's
right.
Usual suspects from ALEC. But the polls say we're going to win. We're going to knock this thing down by 20 points. Again, I keep saying over and over again, don't get overconfident. Go out and vote. But we're in a place to stop these guys.
There you go. And from your lips to God's ears. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, your calls, and I got to tell you what's going on with the Gang of 12 as well. Stick around.
A thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Phil in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Phil, you have an update on Occupy San Francisco?
Well, yes. We've been up all night. Forgive me for a little sleepyhead here, but we had the mayor announce that he was going to be sending the police chief over to clear out the camp, and so we had called out to all of the Bay Area, including the Oakland Occupy movement, and we had about 1,500 to 1,800 people show up at night last night, and the 200-plus police force that was amassed stayed about till 3 o'clock, till about 3 o'clock, and then they called it a night. So they called off the raid last night. We don't know if they're going to come back tonight, but I just wanted to add quickly that you have been a great supporter, and I appreciate that. And I also want to thank you for singling out Scott Olson, who is a member of Occupy San Francisco, and night before last, when he heard the police were going to raid the Oakland encampment, he went to Oakland to support them. So he is our brother, and we appreciate you acknowledging him, sir.
Sure. Yeah, no, he's, it's tragic what happened. And this is what happens when violence comes into politics. And violence, frankly, has no place in politics. And
right.
It's just this mayor in Oakland should be recalled at the very least, or should resign.
She will be recalled because a poll came out yesterday. She has a 20% approval rating in citizens over her handling of this case. But the mayors all over the country right now have a bit of a problem.
Yep.
Number one, because they originally came out as supporting this, and now the police department, the law enforcement in this country is dialing back on the mayors. They've gotten themselves in a big problem. But I think Mr. Goldberg had it exactly right. This movement is really not about creating policy in the squares that we've occupied. It is about the citizens reclaiming the public space. And
yep.
as they reclaim the public space, we can begin to start to provide for better direction for our representatives, for outcomes for all of us.
Yeah. Well, and this is where, you know, Danny Goldberg, he quoted the leader of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, back in the 60s, who kind of mocked, well, in fact, this is the word Danny used, mocked Martin Luther King by saying, how many laws have you changed? Because Martin Luther King was not doing policy, and the NAACP was. And King said, I don't know, but we've changed a lot of hearts. And I think that that's what's going on. Phil, thank you for the report. Keep us up to date, okay?
You bet.
And give our very best to everybody out there. Martin in Washington, New Jersey. Hey, Martin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, Einstein said science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind.
That's correct.
But I disagree. I'm an ardent atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that you have to have both to be a moral person. I am a very, very moral person, on par with you, and I don't need a God to do that for me.
Yeah, and you know, I think if Einstein was around today, instead of using the word religion, he'd probably use the word spirituality.
He became an atheist towards the end of his life.
Richard Dawkins was on this program, what, a week and a half ago?
Yeah.
And we started talking about spirituality, and Richard Dawkins is the president of the Atheist Society in the UK. He's an evangelical atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this spirituality thing has just been hijacked by the religious right crazies in the United States. And he said that he doesn't know, I'm paraphrasing, but you can go back and, you know, if you get the podcast and listen to it. He said that he doesn't know. In fact, it's probably up on our YouTube page at youtube.com/Tom Hartman. He said that he doesn't know of any scientists who don't have a deep spiritual experience when they confront the grandeur of their own particular area of science. He said when he looks at the fossil record, he gets that feeling. You know, when he looks up at the sky at night, he gets that feeling, that deeply spiritual feeling. And yet he calls himself an atheist. And that I think was my point, that the hippie movement was a spiritual movement. It wasn't a religious movement. And in fact, if anything, it was a rejection of religion, of organized religion.
There's so many things in the Bible that are disgusting. Like the Bible says that homosexuals should be stoned. Have you stoned one lately if you believe in the Bible? It just doesn't make sense.
No, the Bible says that you should be stoned if you wear clothing made out of two different fabrics.
Yeah.
I mean,
how
you know, it's,
that?
Yeah, there's
or,
a,
or if you eat pork or shellfish.
Right. No, Martin, I'm with you in all the arguments against organized religion and particularly, you know, ancient, read the book of Joshua. You know, God told him to go into the city and kill every living thing, cut open the bellies of the pregnant women. I mean, you know, what
is
kind of God would do that?
To?
Right.
Is that something to look up to?
But see, that's that. But I think that what that illustrates is the difference between spirituality and religion. And as I said, I having been there, the hippie movement was a spiritual movement that was counterculture, that was opposed to the religion, the institutionalized religions of the day. And
which are all cults.
I would agree with that. And I would submit to you, and this was Danny's point, is that the drum circles and the let me give you a hug, brother, part of the Occupy movements, which is, and there's actually conflict in just as there was in the 60s between SDS and hippies, there's conflict between the people who are the hardcore, hey, we're the political people, we're going to change the, you know, we're going to bring down the machine, this kind of stuff, and we don't have long hair, and we're not, you know, we don't do drum circles, and we don't do that hippy-dippy stuff. I would say that without that hippy-dippy stuff, without that spiritual component, you know, that spiritual component is what brought us, frankly, the movement to save the earth. You know,
you can call it spiritualism or consciousness. I prefer to call it consciousness.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Everybody is born an atheist. You have to be taught to believe in a religion, and you also have to be taught to hate somebody. Nobody is born hating anybody.
Yeah, I'll go along with that to a point. I would say everybody is also born spiritual, using this definition or consciousness or whatever, in as much as look at the look of awe on a child's face when they learn something. For that matter, you know, I look at, you know, when I come home and Higgins looks at me and he's got this look on his face.
Yeah, it's like, you know, saying about my new cat.
Yeah, 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 it's like, you know, I think that that's a universal thing that all mammals, anything with a limbic brain, feels is that, you know, consciousness, spirituality, awe, something. And then people try to organize it, put it in a box, come up with rules for it, and they form these cults that they call religion. So I think, Martin, we're on the same page, and I'm going to move along. But thank you for your call, and thanks, your thoughtful call. Rick in Humboldt County. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, in observing the 99ers, the criticism has been that there's been no focus. And I thought that it might be useful for the 99ers to take the next step at some point in the future by taking a page from the Tea Partiers. The Tea Partiers went and had, now they have a Tea Party wing in the Republican Party.
Right.
And I thought it might be useful for the 99ers to do the same thing, to run candidates who are specifically identified as 99ers, get them elected, and they could sort of join the already extensive Progressive Party and the Democrats with the Democrats.
The Progressive Caucus, yeah. Yeah, it's a great idea.
I think that, you know, so I just wanted to throw that out there, see what you thought.
I think it's a brilliant idea, and hopefully some Democratic strategist or politician is listening right now, Rick. Thank you very much for sharing it with us. Ray in Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to let you know that Daryl Issa, according to a news source out in San Diego, one of the online newspapers that I was reading, it turns out that he is, obviously, you know, he's investigating Solyndra, but he was involved with a fundraiser. He actually went to a fundraiser hosted by a Solyndra lobbyist to help Mitt Romney out.
Okay.
So I figured I'd let you know that. You know, on top of your hypocrisy, you can use the, like, hypocrisy alert.
Yeah. Well, I think just the fact that Daryl Issa is probably the only member of Congress, maybe there's a couple others, but probably the only member of Congress who's actually a criminal, you know, who actually has a criminal past, who's actually been arrested, and he's the guy who is running the morality campaign for the Republicans as the head of the, you know, House Oversight Committee. It just blows my mind. Thanks for sharing that, Ray. I appreciate it. Sam in Portland, we've got a minute to the break. Sam, what's up?
Well, I wanted to point out to you that the Facebook page of Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan has, at the very top, there is a rather banal there's a rather banal statement about the way that protest was put down the other night, and with a commendation to the police, who she says did an excellent job. It's right now, it's at 11,166 comments, and the vast majority of them are very, very negative. They're comparing her to Kent State. They're telling her, you know, it's time to resign. I don't know how accurate a reflection of the popular sentiment this is, but if Facebook is any indication, I'd say she's
in deep trouble.
About the lowest. Yeah,
I would love to hear from her, frankly, and she has an open invitation here if she wants to come on the program. I would love to hear from her if she imposed this on the police department, or they imposed it on her, or they both thought it was a great idea, because somebody really screwed this thing up. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. And as a result, we've got people in the hospital. We've got, you get it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, a crazy alert, and I still have to tell you about what the six Democrats in the Gang of 12 have laid on the table. I think this is a big mistake.
This occupation won't be one with guns or ammunition. Armed with creativity and righteous indignation, we do all the work, so we have the power to stop it. No workers, no work, not until we share the profits.
There you go. Talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program, and our crazy alert for the day. Colorado Springs police say a man's girlfriend unexpectedly came home just as his online girlfriend was about to show up for a visit. So what do you do? 24-year-old Kevin Gaylor called the police to report his new acquaintance, his online girlfriend, who was showing up for the first time, as a burglar. He was cited with a misdemeanor for false reporting to authorities. What do you do? I don't know. Jacob said one in the hand is better than two in the bush. I don't think he got the double entendre, though, when he said it. Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Kelly in Berkeley. Hey, Kelly, thanks for listening to Green 960. What's up?
Hi. Oh, I went to the Oakland Occupy Wall Street last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been down there before. This is my first time. I'm a gray hair. So it said on the news there were 200 people there. Looking at the size of the crowd, it's closer to 800 to 1,200. They had four helicopters hovering, four that I could count. Police were on the edges. There were a lot of security people there, lots of press, many photographers. There were quite a number of people in the crowd that just seemed to be there to agitate, looking for trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't hear the General Assembly speakers. I could just get a little bit of it, and some were wanting to agitate. Others were trying to calm things down, but you just don't get the sense from, I didn't get the sense from being down there that there was enough people in the crowd that really could control the agitators. And
that's interesting. You wonder if the agitators, as you're describing them, are people who were there who have tasted the violence that the police can visit on people and feel righteously indignant and angry about it, and are just not politically sophisticated enough, or, I don't know quite how to say it, but, don't get it that responding to anger with anger is not the way you do it. Or if there are people who are, there with the intention of screwing things up. We talked to Joshua Holland last night, who was actually down there, and as you were. And maybe he was, closer to the General Assembly or something. He seemed to think that there was the peaceful core was still intact, shall we say?
Yeah, pretty much. When they tore down the fence to keep them out of the grassy area, that's when I took off and left, because at that point I didn't know whether it was going to get violent again or not, and I didn't want to get caught in that. I did talk to a handful of people, and there's Berkeley, the law school at Berkeley is sending people down as legal help.
That's great.
Yeah. So one gal was a monitor, and she was there last night watching because she was going to start duty tonight. Mm. There were people that were there from San Francisco because of the violence the night before. They wanted to come over and show support.
Right. Okay.
There's a lot of pot smoking in the crowd.
Yeah. Well, I view that as the spiritual component of it, but, who am I? Kelly, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate the feedback and the report. Shay in New York City. Hey, Shay, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've heard you misrepresent atheism a few times, and I dig your show, and I totally respect you, but it's really frustrating for me as an atheist to hear it, because I deal with it in my own personal life with my family and friends, so it's hard to hear someone that I respect like you put it out there to the public.
Put what out?
The way you have been.
There's
certain things, like I've heard you say that atheism is a form of religion, or a scientist who has.
No, I've said that evangelical atheism is a form of a religion.
But that doesn't exist, and that's my misinformation. It just doesn't.
People who are running around trying to convert people to atheism. That's my definition of a religion.
Somebody who has a belief system
that they're trying to impose on others.
But what is the belief system of atheism?
The belief system is that there's nothing out there, there's no God, there's nothing supernatural, there is nothing beyond what we can detect with our senses.
But how is that a belief system? That is one belief, that I don't have the belief that you might have, that there's a deistic being that exists in the universe.
Well, I'm not sure there's a deistic being or not,
but
frankly.
That's atheism. It's atheism. So it doesn't tell me anything else about what I feel about the universe or anything. I think sometimes you confuse materialism with atheism. Buddhists are atheists.
Well, if there's a confusion, it's probably between agnosticism and atheism, and there's not good definitions of either, frankly.
That's what I'm talking about, though.
Yeah.
There is a good definition, and I'm going to give it to you. Agnosticism has to do with knowledge, and atheism has to do with belief. We are all agnostics. I'm an atheist. I do not believe there's a deistic being. I can't prove it to you. I just don't have that internal belief. Even when I was raised in the church, I just didn't believe it. Now, I don't know. I'm an agnostic. I don't know that there's a God or not. How could anybody?
So then you're
that?
Not an atheist. Because Richard Dawkins came on this program and said he's an atheist, and he absolutely knows that there is no, that there is nothing supernatural, and just said it just like that.
Well,
he said,
well, I've heard that's, him say that it's highly unlikely, and he doesn't
no,
believe
he said
it.
He absolutely, he has absolutely certainty of it, and that's a belief system, in my opinion.
Yeah, and
I mean, just like, you know, if 300 years ago, somebody had said, hey, did you know that voices can travel thousands of miles across the air and nobody can see them? And people would have said, hey, you're crazy. You know, that's a belief system.
Right.
Well, no, it's just science that hadn't been discovered yet. That's all.
But what I'm saying to you is, any atheist that tells you that they know that there's no God is not, that's not accurate, because that's not knowledge. Atheism is I don't believe.
Right.
Like,
that then becomes a belief system, and I'm telling you, there is no shortage of people who will say that they know for certain, and they want me to know for certain that there's no Christian God, no Jewish God, no spirituality, no nothing. And, you know, if they know that for certain, and or if they believe that for
does.
Certain.
I mean, we're all agnostics. No one knows.
Okay. So now I think we're back to agreeing on our definition, Shay. Okay. It's because I don't know. And apparently you don't either. Shay, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Peter Ferraro is up next. Stick around. That should be fun.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to hour two of our program today. In the last hour, we talked with, we actually got an update from a couple of folks at Occupy San Francisco. In the next hour, we'll be talking with Keith Shannon, Scott Olson's roommate, the fellow who's in the hospital right now with a fractured skull as a result of the police riot, the police violence in Oakland the night before last. And, you know, we'll get into that. We also had Cliff Schechter on talking about what's going on in Ohio with Senate Bill 5. And Danny Goldberg was here talking about how the drum circles of today kind of echo the old hippie movement, which was the spiritual side of the movement, for lack of a better way to say it. And I thought that was a fascinating look at it. And he shared some information about Martin Luther King and his take on that, which I will revisit for you at some point as we go on through the day if you're just tuning in. But just to give you a recap, a real quick one. Right now, Peter Ferrara is on the line with us. He is with the Heartland Institute. Heartland.org is the website. He's a senior fellow of entitlement and budget policy there and the author of the book, America's Ticking Bankruptcy Bomb. Peter, welcome back to our program.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Glad to have you. I have written this piece for the American Spectator titled Obama's Regulatory Excesses and Abuse. I'm kind of confused by this because, you know, the banksters took down the world economy after Phil Graham deregulated them. I want more regulations on these guys.
The financial crisis was caused by regulation. It was regulations that forced the banks to make the subprime loans that were at the root of
the entire crisis. No bank was forced to do anything, Peter.
That's what a regulation does. It forces people to do stuff. And it was regulations that forced the banks to make those subprime loans. And eventually,
no banks were forced to make subprime loans, Peter.
Let me explain it to you. Half of all the mortgages in America were these subprime loans. When the bubble, which the Fed contributed greatly to as well, inevitably popped, the subprime mortgage thing also contributed to the bubble because it increased demand. When that inevitably popped, all these shaky loans collapsed. So all the financial instruments.
I don't disagree with you on that, but the banks were not being forced.
The government caused it. Wall Street actually was one of the victims of the government.
Are you talking about the Community Reinvestment Act?
That was one of the things. Yes, the Community.
That was an anti-redlining law. It said
regulations. There were the lawsuits from HUD and Justice.
Yeah, and these were all anti-redlining laws. And Peter, I'm assuming you know that more than half of all the mortgages that were written, subprime mortgages, that were written for people of color during that bubble, more than half of them were for people who qualified for prime mortgages and were not informed of that because the banks made more money on the subprime mortgages. This had nothing to do with regulations. This had to do with greedy banks that should be regulated.
Here's what happened. It wasn't just the loans made to low-income people. When they loosened the standards, to expand home ownership among people that formerly didn't qualify. The people higher up on the scale who could qualify for prime loans then started speculating with additional loans. So when you were a higher-income person and you saw the housing bubble and you wanted to get a second house and a third house to speculate, you are now able to qualify because when they weakened the standards for the lower-income people, they couldn't say to the higher-income people, well, we're not going to give you a loan based on those standards as
so
well.
You're suggesting that there should have been more regulation.
So that made it a much bigger deal.
So
that is why the...
Peter, you're making the case for regulation.
It was the regulation that forced the banks to make those loans.
No, you just said when we weakened the standards are regulations. When we weakened the regulations, the banks stepped in and said, oh, we can make some money now.
I'm talking about the standards that the mortgage companies use to determine who qualifies.
Aren't those standards regulations?
Forced them to weaken those standards.
Oh, come on.
That's the whole point. That's the whole argument. I'm sorry you never heard this argument, but that's the
I've heard it over and over, America. And I've seen it debunked a dozen different times. Are you trying to say that Wall Street is the victim?
I don't know how you can discuss it intelligently when you're not even aware of the debate. That's the whole debate on the other side. It was caused by the government. Also, the Fed pumped up the housing bubble with their overly loose monetary policy. It's why they need to be required to have a link to gold so they don't keep creating these bubbles between the Fed, which was a Bush administration problem, and the subprime fiasco, which was a Clinton administration problem. The government worked together to create the whole financial crisis.
I would say the Fed has been a problem since 1913, but the fact of the matter is, Peter, that the reason why the Fed had to shovel out somewhere between $13 and $20 trillion with a T, when the entire GDP of the United States is only $15 trillion, why the Fed shoveled out more than the entire national GDP in secret. We didn't find this out until Bernie Sanders forced through an audit and Ron Paul forced through an audit of them, a one-year audit. The reason they did that is not because the banks were giving mortgages, but because the banks were creating bets on the mortgages.
That monetary policy was not related to the mortgages.
Peter,
it started in 2001. There wasn't
$30 trillion worth of mortgages. You know, it was the collateralized debt obligations. It was the bets on the mortgages that went bad.
That was not the cause of the Fed monetary policy. It was Fed mis.
No, that's but that was what caused the crash.
Independent of the subprime mortgage crisis, it wasn't the subprime mortgages that caused the Fed to screw up. It was bad Fed policy, and it was a Bush administration desire for a cheap dollar, thinking that would promote.
Peter, are you denying that our going in 1999 from zero, unregulated, you know, no marketplace, no unregulated marketplace, no gray marketplace where banks could trade collateralized debt obligation, CDOs and CDSs, and basically bets on bets on bets that had no intrinsic value other than way down the road some underlying mortgage. And that market became somewhere between a $700 and $900 trillion marketplace. Are you denying that coming into existence over a 9-year period and then crashing was the cause of the bank crash? Because that's what I heard from George Bush.
Okay, are you asking the question and answering it yourself? The CDOs and derivatives were not a cause of the financial crisis. The fundamental cause was the housing bubble, which was caused by the Fed's policies and by the subprime mortgage.
But had the housing bubble crashed without those CDOs, we wouldn't have had to bail out the banks.
If I'm going to explain this complicated thing, you need to let me finish a sentence. It caused housing prices to roar way ahead of where the market could support them, so inevitably they popped. And so all the securities related, the financial instruments related to housing then collapsed. It wasn't the financial instruments that caused it. It was the factors that caused the housing bubble.
But
if it had just been
the housing bubble that collapsed, it wouldn't have been a multi-trillion-dollar worldwide collapse, and it wouldn't have taken down pension funds.
Sorry, you're talking over me. Start that sentence over.
If it had just been the housing bubble that collapsed, because we loosened regulations on banks. If it hadn't been if the housing bubble had collapsed, it wouldn't have been a worldwide disaster. It wouldn't have taken down state pension funds because they were not invested in the mortgages. They were invested in the CDOs, in the bets on the mortgages.
If it was just the housing bubble that collapsed, yes, it would not have been as big of a problem because you wouldn't have all the subprime mortgages that made the market far more vulnerable.
Okay, so will you agree with me that we need more regulations to prevent this?
Those mortgages were caused by regulation, not by deregulation. It was the regulations that forced the banks.
Well, let's regulate against them then.
In the first place.
Let's pass regulations to say we can't force banks to do this.
For hundreds of years, that they had these traditional lending standards that worked well. But in 1995, Clinton said, oh, I have this brilliant idea. We're going to increase home ownership at no cost to taxpayers, and we're going to trash those lending standards by regulation. And so it was the bank examiner regulations, the Community Reinvestment Act regulations, the anti-redlining regulations, the suits by HUD and by Justice to enforce those regulations. In my book, there's a whole chapter devoted to causes of the financial crisis.
Sure,
and
I got it.
Your listeners contact me saying they want to hear alternative views. Well, get the book and you'll hear alternative views.
And you can read alternative views. So you're saying that we need to regulate the regulations. We need to have regulations to say you can't do this. Is that right?
No, we want to keep the government out.
You just want to let the banksters do whatever they want.
The government. Let them do anything they want. Banks are heavily regulated, and no one is saying no regulation. So that's a false choice. And your analysis is always either an ad hominem attack or a false choice.
Okay, I don't recall any ad hominems here.
Aristotelian logic. So you can't even.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Peter Ferrara, heartland.org, the website. Peter, thank you for being with us today. Peter's gone. Okay. 15 minutes past the hour.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school.
Geek.
And proud.
Our geeky science alert, the minute or three during the week when I share with you my favorite science story of the week, and then we'll get back to the news and to your calls. This is from Science News, and... this is really quite amazing. They have found a way to treat pneumonia that doesn't involve drugs. And it's actually a technique that has roots back 100 years or more ago. But now they're doing it. This was at the St. Mary's Hospital Medical School in London. And what they're doing is in high temperature pneumonia patients, people who are like really, really sick and not responding to antibiotics, they injected them with intravenous olive oil. The olive oil, these are super unsaturated fats, which means they're like sponges. They're like fat sponges. And as they go through the body, anything that's fat soluble dissolves into these olive oil molecules and is rendered relatively harmless. So here's the story. You know, the olive oil is emulsified and then injected into the veins. Do not do this at home, by the way. And the high temperature of pneumonia patients dropped to normal within 24 hours after the oil injection, and 3 weeks later, the patients were well. This was due to the absorption of the pneumonia and other toxins circulating in the blood. These poisons lose their potency after adhering to the globules of oil. Pretty cool, huh? So anyhow, our geeky science for the day. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Charles in Los Angeles. Hey, Charles, thanks for listening to KTLK. What's up?
Yeah, well, the problem with the deregulation with the home, with these mortgages, had the same thing happen back in the 80s and 90s with the savings and loan crisis. Yeah, 747 out of 3,234 savings and loans went under because of deregulation during the Reagan-Bush years.
Yeah, because Reagan deregulated them in 83 and they crashed in 86.
Exactly. And so now you had a similar thing, right at the end, the last day of, Clinton's administration, he repealed this Glass-Steagall.
Yeah.
And that opened up the floodgates to private investors making all these crazy loans, these subprime loans. Nobody forced banks to make subprime loans. Nobody forced private investors to make it. They made it because they were making a big profit.
That's right.
And it artificially caused the, price of real estate to go up, and then they flipped the loans and they sold them off and bundled them up and stuff. So that's what caused the crisis. The crisis was the deregulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my point. But I'm telling you, the Republicans and the right wingers have their talking points, and they will not move off them for nothing.
Well, we just got to let people know what the truth is, and keep hammering away.
You bet. I mean, it just makes sense. I mean, if a bankster is saying, oh, these regulations, they're forcing me to make loans that I don't want to make. Well, then, you know, don't make them. I mean, do something else. Go out of the banking business or something if you think that it's going to put you at risk. You know,
here's what they should do. Here's the solution is just make it so the only home loan you can get would be a fixed rate loan. That'll solve the problem all right there. But what happened was Daniel Mudd, he took over at the Fannie Mae back in 2007, and he exposed Fannie Mae to this crazy subprime market.
Yeah.
It ended up like 25% of their loans became subprime loans.
Yep.
Daniel Mudd, he was convinced, oh, we'll make a lot of money. And then we saw what happened.
And then Fannie Mae went down. And in fact, Jacob's got someplace a clip of George W. Bush talking about how, you know, we've got to get poor people into homes. You know, this is the housing is really important. And he was pushing this stuff too. Charles, well said. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Ed in Sauvie Island. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be quick. I've been a long-time listener. I have friends on Facebook that have sent me friend requests just because it says Ed is a member or going to the Tom Hartman University. So, but real quick, this deal, like the last caller, there's a movie called Inside Job. You can go to YouTube, get the link to the promotional video of that, and that has been the best educational tool I've used, sharing that with both parties. Friends that I have that are both outraged by what they've seen in that movie, and it's waking them up.
Yeah.
And as far as the protest goes, we stopped the Vietnam War by protesting, and anybody that's in denial about that is just trying to rewrite history. And the thing that's upsetting me about what's going on now, what they're saying about the people in the Occupy, is they don't have a focus or anything. Well, there's just so many things wrong with the country that it's hard to put it all on one sign.
I think you can boil it down to
everybody knows we're getting screwed here, and you know, and then just one quick thing: they're blaming the brown people, and I'm getting a lot of rhetoric about the illegal immigrants are the reason the country's in trouble, which is ridiculous. Right. And then one last thing, Tom, I'm going to be living in my car starting Monday, so I'm a little biased about what's going on. I've been in the same house for 26 years. I can't find work. I've gone through my savings. I'm one of those people that was responsible. I had money in the bank. I was good to go for my future, and the jobs just disappeared.
Ed, I'm so sorry to hear that.
I'm going to be living in my car, dude. And if I could say one last thing.
Yeah.
The people that are, they're constantly talking about the marijuana clouds at these protests. Can you imagine 10,000 drunk people mad protesting the riots that would come of this?
Well, you have that after a lot of football games.
Yes,
it's like, you know, have you watched soccer in the UK?
Battle, but I wanted to get my stuff in, Tom.
Okay, you did good, Ed, and I'm sorry to hear about your circumstances, and I wish you the best. I'm sure you'll bounce back.
I'm going to be posting on my Facebook my experiences, Tom, and you've motivated me. I've always wanted to write a book. I want to document who these people are and how many of them are just like me, good, hardworking Americans that have got screwed over by both parties by what they're doing, shipping our jobs overseas.
And here's a tip,
and I hope to find somebody to help me, and I want to publish a book and just get the story out, because these are not lazy people. These are hardworking Americans that have gotten screwed here, Tom, and everybody's starting to wake up to that fact.
You're absolutely right, and here's a tip. If you write 5 pages a day, 7 days a week, you'll write a book in 3 months.
Well, or great tip, Tom, and you are my, remember me when you were on Air America here in Portland? You're my political sensei, and you've always been.
Okay, well, thank you, Ed. It's very, very kind to hear from you, and I wish you the very best. Keep in touch with us and keep us up to date on what's going on. Good to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 Democrats in the gang of 12 have come up with $3 trillion in savings, including Medicare cuts. More on that after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, your calls, and you're welcome to drop by our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com. We're going to be giving away a copy of the brand-new book, The Tom Hartman Reader, later on in the show.
May take a week, and it may take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, well. Taking over. Come on!
Welcome back. Viagra for your brain. Not only does not lead to stiff thinking, the Tom Hartman Program. Our conservative alert for the day. This is an actual clip of somebody at one of the Occupy Wall Street movements who, I believe this was in New York. Was this in Manhattan, Jacob? Yeah. And this is from, this video and audio is from somebody who, you know, somebody on the Occupy Wall Street movement side, who found a conservative blogger passing out bongs to people and then asking them to pose with them so that he could take pictures of them and put them on right-wing websites. Here's the little dialogue, the interchange.
You have bongs in your backpack, and are you taking pictures with people with Che Guevara bongs you might want to leave?
Che Guevara rolling papers.
Are you taking pictures of people with that?
Yeah, we're giving
these. Are we going to expect to see those pictures on Fox News?
I don't know if they'll pick it up. Maybe you'll see it on CNN.
So that's why you're giving it out?
Fox!
For a visual for Fox News? No, I don't smoke weed, man.
You can make, this isn't just for weed.
But I don't smoke, man. What's the purpose of, like, showing, taking pictures of people with bongs and giving out bongs?
Is there some wrong?
So you're giving away bongs?
What should we give?
Why don't you give us some thermals? We're staying through the window. Not bongs.
Well, next time I come here.
How about a blanket? People need blankets. How about a blanket? People need blankets. You could give away a sandwich, a free pizza.
So, you know, that's what it's resorted to. That's what it's come to is, you know, some guy thinking that he's a wannabe James O'Keefe, who's a wannabe, I don't know what. But anyway, it's really kind of tragic. It's really quite tragic. Danny in Bluefield, West Virginia. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I wanted to refute Mr. Ferrara's comments. His argument was developed by the Heritage Foundation to divert attention away from the true culprits. If you look at, first of all, the Community Redevelopment Act specifically says that banks and lending institutions should give fair treatment to anyone within red line zones consistent with sound banking practices.
Yep.
In other words, it doesn't force anyone to do anything. And the banks never would have given out loans under pressure from the government. They just wouldn't do that.
That's right.
That's number one. If you look at the record, you remember the revision of the bankruptcy laws? They repealed Glass-Steagall,
mm-hmm.
Then they put a law through to change the bankruptcy laws so that people's homes would not be protected under the previous bankruptcy law that they had been protected.
Right.
This was a series of actions where Wall Street got the Republicans to take away the regulatory protections that had been put in the Depression and gradually leave the American people completely vulnerable.
Yes.
And it was a deliberate act. The center of the subprime mortgages was in Orange County, California, which is a Republican area.
Mm-hmm.
It was all about getting fees and bundling mortgages and moving the money, and they didn't care about the credentials because everybody was making money all up the line.
Yep.
And it was all about making money, nothing else.
Yep.
But the Heritage Institute, like the Manhattan Institute and the Cato Institute and the Hudson Institute, are all organizations funded in order to put out propaganda.
Yeah, by the Koch brothers in large part, among others.
By the Koch brothers and Richard Mellon Scaife and other people.
Yeah.
Steve Forbes and
Reverend Moon,
who were billionaires. And obviously their supply-side theories have really paid off for the supply side, haven't they?
Well, their supply-side theories have really paid off for the top 1%. And that's, you know, somebody called earlier and said, you know, we need, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement isn't all that, you know, focused, blah, blah, blah. I think it's very focused. We are the 99%. There is no better message than that. And everything that flows out of that, there's 1,000 things that can flow out of it. But they all have that as a moral core. And I think that's very well said. Danny, thank you for the call. You're absolutely spot on in your facts. And much appreciated. Good to hear from you. Mark in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. Hope you're well.
Yeah, your guest, Peter Farrar, I don't know why you have him on because there's no talking to him. But the thing I really call
Hope springs
about
eternal,
is
Mark.
Mortgages.
Okay.
What's that?
I said hope springs eternal. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess. You're too kind. But anyway, anybody who thinks that the financial crisis was caused by subprime mortgages is way off base.
He's a Republican.
It's very simple. You can't write a mortgage without mortgage insurance unless you got 20% equity in the house. How many people with bad credit who got subprime mortgages do you think there were who had 20% to put down on a house?
Zero.
The number would be zero.
Yeah.
Every one of those mortgages should have been backed by private mortgage insurance.
I thought mortgage insurance just guaranteed that the chain of custody, I know that's the wrong phrase, but basically the chain of ownership of the mortgages back
that's
into
title insurance.
Oh, that's title insurance. Okay, so mortgage insurance is something different.
You can't write a mortgage without private mortgage insurance unless there's more than 20% equity in the house.
Right.
So every subprime mortgage that went bad, there should have been a counterparty to that risk who would come in and make it right.
Right, but there wasn't, because there was no regulation requiring a counterparty to that risk.
Exactly.
So,
the banks took the banks charged for the private mortgage insurance, but they never bought the private mortgage insurance with it. They just put it in their coffers.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And then they made huge bets. You know, they bundled it together, and then they made huge bets on it, and then they made bets against it. And then when it all crashed, when this whole house of cards crashed, they came to us and to the Fed and said, give us a bunch of money. And we gave $45 billion to the Bank of America. And the way that they're thanking us is by saying, oh, by the way, if you want to use your debit card, it's going to be an extra $5 a month, because we have the right to make a profit, to quote them. And it's insane. Mark, thank you very much. Very well said. Phil in Eureka, California. Hey, Phil, what's up? Thanks for listening to KGOE.
Yeah, I was just calling. I think it would do a lot of people good to start reading their Saul Alinsky again.
Yeah, you know, his Rules for Radicals was one of my BuzzFlash books of the month over at BuzzFlash.com about 6 months ago or so. And it's an excellent book. And frankly, it's been being followed very, very well and thoughtfully by the right for the better part of, you know, basically since the Nixon years.
Yeah, well, the left needs to start working on it. I mean, he's the grandfather of organizing.
Yeah.
And I think we need to go that. I think we all start to need to follow him.
Well, it's just, I mean, what Alinsky did is he didn't come out and say, you know, here's step by step what you have to do. Instead, he said, here's step by step what has worked in the past. And these are the things that are characteristic of successful movements. And, you know, he was more of an anthropologist than a preacher. His analysis was accurate. And as I said, the right wing has been doing this. They've been and what has happened is that the old Republican Party of Richard Nixon, which wasn't particularly radical, got taken over by the modern radical Republican Party of Ronald Reagan and forward. And the neocons with the Bush administration, the last Bush administration, and they are genuine radicals. I mean, super radicals. And they're doing Alinsky on steroids. So, Phil, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much for that. Dwayne in Monterey. Hey, Dwayne, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I agree with the other caller about having Peter on. I just don't understand the sense they would have him on there. First thing is, in 2000, the Federal Reserve report, that lending under the act was general. This is the CRA.
Yeah,
was generally profitable and not overly risky. By contrast, in 2002 to 2007 period, the act's enforcement was weak. Its advocates had little influence with Congress. In 2003, President Bush's chief regulator, holding a chainsaw in his hand as a prop, boasted of his plan to cut banking regulations, including the scope of the Reinvestment Act and his enforcement staff,
right,
which he carried out over the next 2 years.
Right.
But
and Bush was out bragging about it, actually.
Yeah. Exactly, and have this mean, like, oh, there's poor people, people of color. It's like, are you kidding me? You guys were warned in 2004 by the FBI of an epidemic mortgage fraud that could rival the savings and loan crisis. You guys took agents off of the beat.
Yeah, and they did.
They put people in office who don't believe in government, and then they're surprised when government doesn't work.
Well, actually, they're not surprised. This is a very methodical thing that's been going on since the 80s, which is putting incompetence. It's like Bill Bennett, you know, the gambling addict who wrote the book called The Book of Morals or something like that. And Bill Bennett, who ran the one time when he ran for either Congress or the White House way back in the 70s, ran on a platform of ending the education department. That was his thing. Abolish the Department of Education. So what does Ronald Reagan, who does Ronald Reagan put in charge of the Department of Education when he becomes president? Bill Bennett. And George W. Bush. Okay, he doesn't like FEMA. You know, FEMA is a very successful federal program. They don't like successful federal programs. It's why they hate Social Security, because it gives people confidence in their government. It gives people confidence that maybe George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, maybe those guys did something worthwhile. And created a nation that actually could work. And so George W. Bush comes in and says, you know, we can't have that. We can't have people trusting the government. They've got to trust big transnational corporations instead. They got to trust Halliburton instead. And so, you know, let's blow up FEMA by putting a total incompetent in charge of it. and people, 1,800 people died as a result of that. Almost as many people died in Katrina as died in Katrina and the storm that followed. I forget the name of it, and as died in 9/11, and as the result, you know, the direct result of incompetence of the Bush administration. And no, you know, to this day, nobody's talking about that, which constantly has me scratching my head. So, anyway, the best post over on our message board today, Louise is going to pull out, and the book that Van Jones said, never one to shy away from the truth, Tom Hartman's collected works are inspiring, wise, and compelling. His work lights the way to a better America. We'll give that
You're
book away.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what's going on with them as well, you know, around the world and here in Washington, D.C. with their reporters. Just a minute.
To the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Brought to you by Ellen's birthday site, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, helping out, returning former slaves in the country of South Sudan. Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Okay, well, the president spoke about No Child Left Behind this morning. He said the goals of No Child Left Behind were actually, they were right. President Bush had it right, but we have to stay focused on that goal. However, the way that No Child Left Behind was implemented has some serious flaws. And he said, starting today, we're going to be giving states the flexibility to meet those goals and to provide what's needed, but not to really have to be so over-regulated.
Is this part of his "we can't wait, I'm going to do executive orders" program?
This is part of his "we can't wait." This is part of, look, I'm going to take the bull by the horns, and I'm going to be president here, and if Congress can't come along, well, so be it.
Interesting. Okay.
The White House talked a lot about the super committee. They said basically the president's put forward a plan. They said we're not going to take off the table revenues. As you know, yesterday the Democrats said, hey, we'll even take $3 trillion with a T off the non-discretionary spending, Social Security, Medicare. But we want $1 trillion with a T, dollars in some kind of tax increases. And the White House said today, again, that we cannot say that the burden should be borne by the middle class. Independents and Republicans have this view everywhere except Washington.
Right. Yeah, it very much is the bubble here. It's just astounding. All across America, all this pain, the 99% collapsing, the 1%. 257% increase in income since Ronald Reagan's presidency. Average working people, you know, wages have actually fallen 28% for individual workers. Family household household income has gone up slightly, but that's because two people are working now. And they seem not to get it here. The Republicans certainly don't get it at all. And there's a, you know, good solid progressive caucus here that gets it in the Democratic Party. But anyway.
Also today, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, as you know, she has just come back from the entire Mideast region, et cetera, and she said, look, we want a full military withdrawal from Afghanistan by 2014. The White House reiterated that today. She said there are very serious challenges in terms of a sustainable and civilian-oriented government. She said, we are entering with the right dose of humility. And in the beginning, perhaps, she said, we didn't have enough of that. And you know who that was sticking it to.
Yeah, George W. I'm just curious. Hamid Karzai, a couple of days ago on Pakistani television, which probably has to be, that caveat has to be acknowledged, said words to the effect of, if there was a war between the United States and Pakistan, Afghanistan would be on Pakistan's side. On the one hand, that makes sense. They're talking about their next door neighbor and a nuclear power. You know, it's sort of like saying if there was a war between France and Canada, we'd be on Canada's side.
Right.
But on the other hand, it raised a lot of eyebrows here. What's the fallout from that? And was that part?
Well,
was that
not,
why Hillary was kind of Go ahead.
I didn't sit through the Hillary Clinton thing. It did not come up at the White House in terms of that today. The way it came up at the White House is, are we still planning on withdrawing? What about our plans? And I actually did not like the response from Jay Carney. He said, well, the president keeps his commitments. Well, yes, the president should keep the commitments, but if the commitments are going to hurt us one way or the other, I just thought he should have said, look, we're on target and we're working in that direction.
Yeah.
And then Secretary Clinton was asked about positive negotiations with the Taliban. She said there are encouraging signs. Also, today, unfortunately, there was a military base in Kandahar it was attacked. There were some militants that opened up on the facility. However, no Americans or anybody who was not a militant, an attacker, was killed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they're still out there looking around. Okay, some other interesting things going on. The Supreme Court said that they are going to begin their review of the various challenges to the President Obama health care law, called the Affordable Care Act. The justices are going to meet on November 10th. That's a Thursday. They're going to review any of the petitions filed by both people who are opponents of the law and the Department of Justice on behalf of the administration. The review is preliminary, but it will set the stage now for oral arguments and a decision, and it's a very good chance that it might be heard during this term, which means that a decision might fall right before the presidentials or this summer, which, of course, is before the various conventions, et cetera. And also, Congressman Paul Braun, he's a Republican from Georgia, he's a medical doctor, and he filed an amicus brief with the Supreme Court requesting its review of the constitutionality of the health care law. He did this with the American Center for Law and Justice. Not exactly, you know.
Yeah, it's a right-wing group. Yeah.
105 members of Congress signed on to his amicus brief.
Wow.
So
it's going to be interesting to see. What I'm going to be really curious about is whether Clarence Thomas recuses himself, because his wife has been working on this issue for some time.
Clarence Thomas doesn't recuse himself from anything. And, you know, it's interesting. My brother Michael believes that there should actually be an impeachment against him. Because
I agree.
During his hearings, he made this comment. It was a very well-known comment that he saw, you know, these African-American kids getting off these buses to go to the court every day, and he had great feelings for prisoners. Well, he has voted against every prisoner right thing since he got on the court.
Yeah, he's just been a hard right vote consistently. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Keith Shannon is on the line with us. He is the roommate of Scott Olson, the fellow who was deployed. In fact, he was deployed with Scott to Iraq. I should let Keith tell his own story. Keith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Scott Olson, of course, the young man who was hit with, I've seen different reports. My understanding is it was a tear gas canister, but some people have said, no, it was a rubber bullet. What fractured his skull night before last in Oakland?
We're pretty sure it was a tear gas canister.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's not 100% verified, but that's what we're pretty sure it was.
Okay. And how is he?
He was actually just recently upgraded to fair condition, and they took him off the respirator, and he's breathing on his own. However, they are going to have to go in to relieve the swelling in his brain in the next day or two.
Yikes. So. You mean they're going to have to do brain surgery? Open his skull?
I'm not exactly sure how they're going to do it, but he has a 2-inch fracture in his skull, so I guess that helped relieve some of it, but they're going to have to relieve more pressure, so I'm not sure how they're going to go about doing that.
Wow. Were you there that night?
No, I was not. And I was at home that night.
Yeah. Did Scott have an opportunity to share any of the story with you, or has he been largely unkind? I mean, if you're on a respirator, you got tubes down your throat, you can't talk. Has he been?
Well, he was sedated once he got to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He was walking in, and I don't remember the term the doctors used, but when he got in there, he knew what he wanted to say, but he wasn't able to articulate it. He was only able to answer yes or no questions,
right.
And he's been sedated. He hasn't been conscious since he was in the hospital.
Yeah, I think that's called aphasia, isn't it? But maybe I'm
something like
maybe
that.
I'm wrong. Yeah, I'm assuming that there has been an outpouring of support for Scott. Is there a way that, you know, has there been a Facebook page set up or a website or anything where people can send him well wishes and that kind of
there. I don't know if there's a Facebook page. I have like a Google group set up that for people who want to receive updates on him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the link on that right now. However, people can send like donations to help pay for stuff at ibaw.org. Click on donate and then go to special cases and type in Scott Olson.
Okay.
And I'll actually look into seeing where they can send well wishes and stuff.
Okay, IVAW.org. That's as in Iraq and...
Iraq Veterans Against
Veterans
the War.
Veterans Against the War, yeah, okay. Wow, this is just absolutely extraordinary. What's your take on the significance of this? What are your thoughts on the Occupy Wall Street Oakland? And I realize Scott was a member of Occupy Wall Street San Francisco and went over to Oakland when he learned that there was going to be a big action there. What are your thoughts on this?
Like on what exactly happened to Scott or the movement in general?
Both.
In terms of Scott, I think it's really sad and just terrible that, you know, he can go to two tours in Iraq, come back completely uninjured, except for obviously some, you know, mental scarring that's going to be there, and come back uninjured and then be shot by the very people who's supposed to protect him while he's exercising the rights that he fought for,
mm-hmm.
Peacefully.
Yeah.
So.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, no, go ahead.
No, you were going to say something else?
Oh, and, in terms of the movement, I think it's going to, be a boost for the participation. It's unfortunate that it takes an event like this to, bring a lot more people and attention to it. But I think you need to be happy that a negative event like this has been turned into a very good publicity for the movement and bringing a lot more people and attention to it and the negativity towards what the police have done and the way the government's trying to contain it.
Right, Keith, you were deployed to Iraq along with Scott. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
As a soldier, or were you a Marine, or what?
Marine.
Okay, as a Marine, who served his country in Iraq, and certainly the pitch for that was defend your country, stand up for the values of your country, without getting into a debate of the war and George W. Bush or any of that kind of nonsense. But as a person who served your country, I'm curious your thoughts of your personal take and if you know Scott's, I'd like to hear your if you can relate his thoughts to us of what Occupy Wall Street means relative to what it means to be an American and a patriot.
Right. Well, Scott and I both have been against the war even while we were deployed. Scott's been very active in Iraq Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace. And he's been very passionate about the Occupy movement. And he sees it as a way, unlike our tours in Iraq, to really actually make a difference that matters, to really help people that need it instead of tearing apart.
Does Scott have health insurance?
Yes, he does.
Okay. So he's not in a desperate situation right now.
No.
Financially. But still, there's got to be a lot of costs associated with this. And if people want to donate to this or participate, they can go to IVAW.org, Iraq Veterans Against the War.org, and click on the donate button and then click on the special cases, and you'll find Scott Olson's name there. And Keith Shannon, you're doing good. You're Scott's got a good friend there. I think all of us would be honored and pleased to have somebody standing up for us in a time of need like this, like you're doing.
Thanks. And I'm sure he would do exactly the same thing if it was reversed. So.
I would like to think so, but I salute you and Scott. And please, would you share our very best regards with him?
Will do. Thank you.
Keith, thanks so much for being with us. Great talking with you today. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Ken in Holland Park, Illinois. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, we talk about Frank Luntz, like branding influences a lot. I'd just like to offer that the multiple issues of the Occupy movement might best be summarized as the conscience of kleptocracy.
The conscience of kleptocracy. Kleptocracy, of course, being a form of government run by thieves.
Yeah.
And the lack of conscience. Yeah. Okay. That's a very interesting frame and meme. Thanks for sharing that, Ken. I appreciate it. Donna in Seattle. Hey, Donna, what's up?
Hi. Thanks. Thanks so much, Tom. I just have a suggestion on how people can help occupy Wall Street, and it comes from the civil rights movement, where they actually train people in nonviolent resistance. Because I really think if people do that, this will be a success. And if people can make flyers on good resources on nonviolent resistance, pass it around at events. Also, people that – there's lots of websites for – like I know there's one for Seattle. If they can call websites and either give them good resources, they can create their own flyers to make these resources available to people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be – and just really educate people. Because I know during the Civil Rights Movement, they actually had training for people.
In fact, Rosa Parks
– nonviolence resistance.
Yeah, Rosa Parks went through that. But they actually are doing that. Jacob has been down to the one here in D.C. And all over the country. They actually are conducting nonviolence training sessions at
they are. Okay,
yeah,
great.
Yeah,
yeah, and so. I'd really like to see, you know, even more of it, you know, and really spreading the word, because that's really, I think, the main way it's really going to be successful.
The way to irrefutably reveal, to show to the world the brutality of a system that has been bought out and corrupted by the very powerful and the very wealthy, is to stand in nonviolence, is to stand basically naked in front of the world and take the shots, and not literally, but figuratively. And in some of the Middle Eastern, the Arab Spring, they literally took the shots. And this is why it's so important that it stay nonviolent and it not become violent like it did in the UK, for example. Donna, thank you for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Republicans are trying to subvert our democracy now. About 24th Amendment. I'll tell you about that right after the break.
There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. Watch that sound. Everybody look what's going down.
Helping you in the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, pound or hashtag OCT29, OCT29. It's the Enough is Enough rally. It's going to be this Saturday at the U.S. Capitol from noon until 6 o'clock the next morning. I'll be kicking off the rally at noon, so be there or be square. Come by and say hi. And there's going to be a lot of good people there. So Oakland, John in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Not much. Thanks for taking my call. Two quick comments. The one caller that said it was it's a kleptocracy.
Yeah.
I was trying to get through the last couple of days regarding that. I was going to call us instead of a representative democracy, a representative corporatocracy.
Yeah.
But it sounds really like this guy hit it. It's a representative kleptocracy is what we have now.
Yeah, and we have it as a result of a series of Supreme Court decisions, pure and simple.
Yes, yes, absolutely. The other thing was I wanted to encourage people to call their – I called, even though I'm about 250 miles away from Oakland, I called the Oakland Police Department and had a conversation with an officer and begged him yesterday that violence begets violence and that you can't just hurt innocent people. If there's people that are doing wrong, urination, some stuff that he said I won't repeat on the air that was happening, then arrest them. But the peaceful protesters, leave them alone. And we could see this in the Scott Olsons of these Occupy movements.
Yeah.
And there's going to be more of them if people don't call, if the police don't calm down.
Yeah, and this is basically the last thing we want is more martyrs for the movement. You know, it's
we don't need that. What we need are, you know, people realizing that they're part of the movement, and that's what I told them. These people are representing you, officer.
Yeah.
You know, you're one of the 99%.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of us out here.
Yep.
You know, you can put down the weapons and stop it. And you know, thankfully, Scott Olsen, he may have took one for all of us in the end.
Yeah.
And,
well, and let's hope and pray that he gets better. And
of course,
IVAW.org. Give him a shout out. John, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Ken in Rose Creek, Minnesota. Hey, Ken.
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Well, I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching MSNBC last night, and I saw Joe the Plumber talking with Ed Schultz.
Uh-huh.
And saying he's running as a Republican instead of a Democrat.
Right.
What's with that?
Well, you know, Joe the Plumber had his 15 minutes of fame back when President Obama, when he was running for president in 2008, walked by him. And, you know, Joe asked him some question about spreading the wealth around. And President Obama gave somewhat inarticulate answer, or not, you know, carefully parsed answer that the Republicans tried to spin into. See, we told you he was a Marxist or communist or socialist. He wants to spread the wealth around. And Joe had lied, actually, to President Obama. He said that he was about to put $250,000 into a plumbing business he was going to buy. And in fact, he was, you know, part time. He wasn't actually a licensed plumber. And his name isn't Joe, actually. It's Samuel. But in any case, he became this kind of iconic, famous figure for a while. And Sarah Palin took him under her wing and dragged him around, and so he became a Republican figure. We had him on our show. He was picked up by one of the right-wing media, Pajamas Media, actually, one of the right-wing media organizations, and they sent him to Israel. And he came back from Israel and was doing the media tour. And, you know, we got solicited as, you know, as a talk show. And you know, along with probably a lot of others. And it was the one and only time in the 9 years I've been doing this show that any guest has ever said, before I'll come on your program, you have to sign this piece of paper that says you will or won't talk about certain things. And so, you know, we kind of debated this internally because it's what it said was that you will only discuss with Joe the Plumber those areas of his expertise. In other words, we wouldn't ask about his personal life. We wouldn't try to play gotcha questions. We wouldn't debate politics with him, those kinds of things. And so finally, let me finish the story. This is hysterical. So finally, I said, okay, let's try this. And so I signed the form. I brought Joe on. I revealed to my audience that I had signed this form. And here's our Joe the Plumber alert.
That's what's coming.
Joe the Plumber Wurzelbacher. Hey, Joe, welcome to the show. What's the best thing to do when your drains are running slow or clogged up?
Well, what I find the best thing to do is fill up both basins or the single basin. And with cold water, hot water really doesn't make the difference. And flush your pipes at least once a week.
So there you go. That's basically for 15 minutes I did nothing but ask him plumbing questions. And he had some pretty good answers, actually. So you still there, Ken?
Yes, I'm still there.
Yeah. So that was our experience with Joe the Plumber. I think, you know, he might be a decent plumber, or Sam the Plumber, actually. But I think he's a little confused politically, and as is any middle-class person who is running for Republican office.
Yes, and he said he was against collective bargaining.
Right.
And he's for a flat tax.
Right.
And he's a blue-collar worker.
Right. Right.
And he's running for an office in Ohio as a Republican.
Right. He's totally confused.
Is he bought and paid for by the Republican Party, or what's going on here?
Well, yeah, I think this has become his business, and I think it probably pays better than being a part-time plumber. You know? He's probably got a book contract. He probably gets speaking gigs. I mean, you know, if you get into the right on this thing, and I can tell you the left, you know, I got caught. I spoke at the Fighting Bob Fest. They don't pay any, nobody pays anything, right, on the left. But on the right, if you're a right-wing talk show host, these billionaires, I mean, you get 10, 20, 30,000 bucks a whack to go out and give a speech. And it's just incredible. So I think that Joe's just got a new gig, that's all. Ken, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the some new word that I can't... We're improving our vocabulary day by day. Ugly. Be the good, the bad, and the very, very sanguisugously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Occupy Oaklanders for taking back the plaza. More than 1,000 activists protesting economic inequality reclaimed a downtown Oakland plaza late on Wednesday, a day after demonstrators were driven out and an Iraq war veteran was critically hurt in clashes with police. The bad, Evan Coyne Maloney, the conservative filmmaker associated with fake journalist hack James O'Keefe, was spotted in New York City at the Occupy Wall Street movement. But he wasn't there to cover the movement like a journalist. He was there to give it a bad name. Maloney was caught handing out bongs and rolling papers to occupiers in hopes of getting a nifty little shot that would likely end up on Fox News later. Luckily, his plan didn't work out as planned, and he was exposed. Maloney defended himself by saying, "I'm giving bongs away because I'm a nice guy and I like giving stuff away." As the right-wing so-called journalist credo goes, if what you're trying to uncover isn't real, then just make it up. Yeah. And the very, very ugly, the House Republican leadership. Being in charge of the House of Representatives, Republican leadership is in charge of figuring out what bills will be brought to the floor and voted on. And they have a lot of splaining to do as to why one specific piece of legislation hasn't moved anywhere. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz introduced legislation to rename a room in the Capitol after Gabe Zimmerman, the congressional aide who was killed while trying to save Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in the Tucson shooting earlier this year. He was the first congressional aide ever killed in the line of duty. The bill has 366 co-sponsors, but has not been voted on, and no one can explain why. The Huffington Post asked Majority Leader Eric Cantor why, and his office directed questions to Speaker John Boehner's office, which declined comment. I guess Republicans are just too busy with their war on women and the EPA, as well as too busy naming post offices after Reagan to honor a hero who was killed, but just happens to be a Democrat. And that's very, very ugly. And by the way, don't forget, Free Speech TV invites citizens journalists from around the world to send their videos of actions in your community that support the 99% movement. You can post them over at freespeech.org. Some may air on DirecTV Channel 348 or Dish TV Channel 9415, which reaches into 35 million households across the U.S. and on cable systems all around the country. Check out freespeech.org for more details on how to submit those things. So, I wanted to touch on this very quickly. Two things. Number one, this fellow, 86-year-old guy in Tennessee. Tennessee has another one of these red states, Republican states, where they have changed the voting laws to say that you've got to have photo ID to vote. So he goes and tries to get photo ID, and the DMV says that'll be $8. The 24th Amendment specifically says you can't charge somebody money, it's called a poll tax, in order to make them eligible to vote. This is nuts. Meanwhile, in Michigan, Republican lawmakers are trying to push through legislation like Florida's to make it harder for people to register people to vote. The League of Women Voters, we had the president on our show a couple days ago, the League of Women Voters has stopped their voter registration drives in Florida. And there's a high school teacher in Florida who's looking at like thousands of dollars in fines because she helped her students who were over 18 and legal citizens and all that kind of thing register to vote. The Republicans are criminalizing the process of voter registration. They get it, that the only way they can win elections is if they can suppress the vote. It is just so wrong. I mean, like, seriously, so wrong. Cliff in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Cliff, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Fine, what's up?
First, I want to thank you. Honest journalism. You can't get it on the major networks.
So. Well, the journalist is Amy Goodman. I'm a commentator. So, but you know, we do talk about the issues. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I think it's an important distinction to make, though.
I didn't know about the Occupy Wall Street until I stumbled on your program. But
okay.
I just wanted to put something out there that the right to keep and bear arms was initiated to prevent things like what happened in Oakland.
Actually,
and,
not.
Well, no, it's against totality. You know, it's against so people can defend themselves when government gets out of hand.
Actually, not. The second, I encourage you to go back and read the history of the Second Amendment. Read the debates in the Congressional Congress. You know, in 1786, 1786 and 17 yeah, it was 1786, the summer of 1786. Read the debates about it. The Constitution of the state of Philadelphia, of the state of Pennsylvania, read that, and this is pretty much verbatim. I'm doing this from memory, but it's pretty much verbatim. Standing armies being the enemy of peace and stability in a republic, every man 14 to 17 to 47 years old shall be a member of a local militia. And in order to promote a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to bear arms shall not be abridged. And that's how it was in the Pennsylvania Constitution. That's how Thomas Jefferson proposed it to the National Convention. And among others, there were many who were saying that. And in fact, Jefferson was so opposed to there being standing armies during times of peace. There was this large contingent of founders who believed that if we had an army when we weren't at war, the army would develop into a military-industrial complex. The army would represent a threat to a civilian government. They had seen throughout the history of Europe in the 16, 15, 14, 13th centuries over and over and over again where the military had, you know, Napoleon, just the whole long list, where basically military groups, standing armies in countries that were not at war, became the ones who overthrew the civilian government and took over the country. And in fact, when Thomas Jefferson came into office in 1800, there were over 300,000 men in our army at that time. And he reduced that down to fewer than 6,000 by the time he left in 1808. He tried to kill off the standing army. So that's and they ended up with this huge debate in the Constitutional Convention about whether or not there should be a standing army. And they couldn't resolve it because they couldn't get enough votes to say, let's in the Constitution ban standing armies. And so the Second Amendment is half of the language, which is why it starts out by saying, in order to maintain a well-regulated militia, the right of citizens to bear arms shall not be abridged. And that was what the debate was about. It was none of those people, you will not find any of them, none of those people envisioned a time in the future where American citizens would take up arms against their own government. In fact, they were horrified by the thought. Had that been their motive, the Second Amendment would say you have the right to a cannon, you have the right to a warship, you have the right to anything necessary to take down a government. And the Second Amendment very much does not say that.
Right.
So, you know,
okay, well,
go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just think, you know, it's terrible. I see this. It's just, I was wondering also, could you maybe throw up an address where a guy could send a check to the young man who got a hit with a tear gas canister?
Yeah, it's IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW.org. And there you go to their website and you click the donate page, and then they've got special cases and you click and it's on the screen right now. Help Scott Olson, IVAW.org.
Okay.
Cliff, thanks a lot for the call. And it just, you know, the founders really did not put the Second Amendment in there so we could overthrow a government. And thank God. Because if everybody in Oakland had been going in, you know, with weapons, you wouldn't have one guy in the hospital, and what would come out of it wouldn't be a democracy. This is my concern about Libya, is that typically when countries experience civil war, violent conflict, as opposed to nonviolent. Nonviolent was Egypt, for example, relatively nonviolent. But when they experience civil war, They typically don't come out of it as democracies. They come out of it as autocracies. And you know, that ain't a good thing. Samuel in Stone Mountain, Georgia. Hey, Samuel, I've been in Stone Mountain. It's a great place. Up on Stone Mountain, in fact. What's up?
I'm fine, thank you. And I call to pick your brain. I don't understand about the Republicans. They don't want the government to get in your business, but they can get in women's business of having abortions and get into people of different sex and getting into just things that cause confusion. Right.
What are you smoking in your living room?
Who, me?
No. I'm saying this is what the Republicans want to know. The Republicans want to know, what are you smoking in your living room? Who are you having sex with in your bedroom? And by the way, do you happen to be pregnant?
Right. And I'm a Christian. But I don't understand these Christians are going along with these Republicans on men's marrying men, women with women. And the abortion is the worst because I don't care who you are or what you do. You have to answer for what you do, not to me or anyone else.
Yeah,
I have my own words to worry about.
Yeah, it's between you, your deity, and your physician, and the rest of your family. That said, I think that we do need a conversation in this country about when life begins, because there are all these bills that are being proposed in state legislatures around the country that would say that life begins at the moment of fertilization. The egg takes several days to then implant in the uterus. And what that would do is basically ban most forms of birth control as well as in vitro fertilization. And that's frankly for me a bridge too far. Let's not turn this into a discussion of abortion. But Samuel, you're right. This is the Republican thing is let's tell you how to run your life. And by the way, we're going to make sure that the billionaires have all the money. It's crazy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Immigrants need not read. Alabama law is getting stranger and stranger right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Hey, James in Franklin, Tennessee, you have some information about Occupy Nashville for us.
That's right.
Go for it.
Thanks a lot, Tom. They're going to try to run us off tonight at 8 o'clock. We can't let that happen, and I'd like to make a plea to your callers to call in. You can go to Occupy Nashville, and you can get the phone numbers to call our representatives and our governor and all that to help us stop this, and just flood them with calls. I sure appreciate it. And what it is the people down there haven't got anywhere to relieve themselves. So instead of putting in Porter Johns, which would be cheaper than having this police state move in on us,
right,
you know, all the way around, I mean, on the economy, and it'd help the people, too, because we are citizens.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to help us here, they're going at it this other way, and I can't understand it.
The cost of putting a porta potty in a park is probably a fraction of the cost of sending three cops down to chase people.
Yes, sir. I'll
I mean, they're not that expensive, you know. They're just not. Uh-huh. You know, my brother rents one for our family reunion every year. You know, they're not that expensive, and you can just bring them in, drop them off, pick them up a couple days later. That's, in fact, maybe that should be the thing. We should thank you for the call, James. That is spot on. Maybe we should start a national fundraising drive to get porta potties for Occupy movements. Allison in Georgetown, Illinois. Hey, Allison, what's up?
Hi, I had a question about the Second Amendment issue that was just raised and your discussion about a standing army, which I thought was pretty informative. We have a standing army right now.
Oh boy, do we ever.
And I would argue that the corporations and the corporate controlled government are using the police as an extension, if you will, of that army against its own people.
I agree.
Circumstances as we're seeing.
I agree.
So my question to you is, does the Second Amendment, in your opinion, provide for our right to defend ourselves in these circumstances?
No.
And
no, it doesn't.
Okay. And if not, how do you feel that, and I don't have it in front of me, the Constitution, but isn't there a section in our Constitution that says that we have the right to take over and reform our government?
You're thinking of
force if necessary, if it comes to circumstances or turns into a corporatocracy.
What you're thinking of is the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The Constitution was written in 1786, you know, a decade later, after the mm-hmm. war was fought, the Revolutionary War was fought. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we have the right to change government other than the provision that gives us the power to amend the Constitution, which has been done 27 or 28 or 29 times, a little short of 30 times since then. But the phrase that you're talking about is from the Declaration of Independence, where Thomas Jefferson wrote, "But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security." Now, that, you know, he was speaking, of course, of throwing off the British government, and the Declaration of Independence has no legal force as law in the United States. It's merely our founding document.
But I'm wondering, do you not feel that the Second Amendment in the spirit of that, because
no.
we went against the standing army of the British?
Yeah, no, I don't. The Second Amendment says, in order to maintain a, I'll get you the exact language here, but I think I have it memorized pretty well. In order to maintain a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the entire Second Amendment.
But the free state being freedom against any kind of oppression, what if it's our own government that's doing that? And I'm not saying to have an armed rebellion against, but
no.
what are our rights to defend? Do we have none?
We have the right to replace our government, and it's called elections. And every single member of the House of Representatives, all 435 of them, stands for re-election every 2 years. Every senator stands for re-election every 6 years, a third of them every 2 years. And the president stands for re-election every 4 years. That's the mechanism by which we can change our government. And, of course, at the state level and local levels as well, it's called elections. And that's
and
why
if the system is corrupted, and I think a lot of people, you know, Occupy Wall Street are, in a way, are arguing that the system is so
yes.
corrupted that how do you even trust the mechanisms that are in place?
This system has been, if you look at the history of the United States, what you see is that the 20s is very analogous to right now. You had three consecutive Republican presidents, Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. When Harding came in, he said that the job, his job as president was to put more business in government and less government in business. And he did so. And he dropped the top tax rate from 95% on multimillionaires down to 25%, the income tax rate. And it produced the Roaring Twenties, which was a bubble, and then the Great Crash of 1929 that took us, you know, 15 years to recover from, maybe arguably longer. But what we saw was that American democracy was sliding backwards during that period of Republican rule. We saw the same thing in the decade leading up to the Civil War. We saw the same thing, I would say, in the decade leading up to the Revolutionary War, when we didn't have a Republican form, small r, form of government. And I actually believe that what is going to come out of this economic crisis that we're experiencing right now, that the Occupy movements are articulating so well and demonstrating so well, what's going to come out of this is a revolution, not a guns shooting revolution, but a revolution at the ballot box, a revolution in our way of political thinking. Our nation goes through these periodic changes, you know, the Civil Rights Act and civil rights law, the Great Society, the New Deal, the Square Deal back during Teddy Roosevelt's time, Reconstruction after the Civil War. We go through these fairly radical changes, and we become a better nation as a result of it. And I believe that the tough times that we're experiencing right now are going to lead us to better times. It's going to get rough for a while, but this is the argument, Allison, for all of us to get involved politically, to show up in the grassroots movements and to show up in the political parties and participate. Allison, thank you so much for the call. We're out of time. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.